Welcome to the third preseason Supercoach Coach podcast for 2022. I'm Marcus and I'm joined again by FB Donkey.
G'day Marcus, g'day everyone, all the listeners. Hope you guys have been enjoying some footy back on our screens. The quality of games already so far this week have been a lot better than that first practice match. It's been some interesting watching.
I'm going to wait to watch a little bit more football before we record our forward show. I think one of the more contentious areas of the ground where there are a lot of live and attractive selections and more mid-prices or breakout contenders that we want to watch. So we'll be recording that after seeing a few more games tomorrow for our Patreons. So a reminder, if you want to catch our positional series, to sign up at patreon.com/supercoachcoach. You can support the show, cancel anytime, $5.50 to support us and get some great preseason content to help pick your teams. In the main show, we are continuing the series that we kicked off last week on how to approach picking your Supercoach team and talking a little bit about strategy. So last week we covered how you pick rookies, mid-price players, and premiums. And this week we're going to go into more specific topics. So we're going to talk about starting structures, comparing sort of the guns and rookies approach to mid-prices, how you should be thinking about what you see in the preseason and how that should influence your picks. Originally, I think we were going to go through by position, you know, how you might approach a backline player, but I think there's a bit of overlap because it starts to get a little bit more into starting structures and things like that. In terms of thinking about specific types of players within the position, so comparing the key backs to rebounding defenders and those sorts of things, we cover some of that nuance on our positional Patreon episode. So we've decided to scrap approaching, I guess, each line by line from a strategy point of view and moving straight into these topics, Mark.
Yep, I think that's smart. So if you want to get that content, sign up to Patreon, jump on there, and it's all in the positional shows.
All right, so we're going to start off with starting structures as the first topic for today. This one is a little bit tougher to give specific advice on year to year. So these are more principles or ways that we approach our starting structure, because every year starting structure is dictated by the players that are available to us and very much by the rookies. So I guess with that as a starting point, might throw to you, Mark. How do you sort of work through what your starting structure looks like? How do you decide how much to spend on each line? What do you take into consideration when trying to balance your Supercoach team?
We say that the rookies dictate how our structures will be, but it is remarkable how similar our structures are from year to year. The first probably spot that you want to check is your ruck line. So are you going to get a cheaper player in there? Or are you going to go with two really high-priced rocks? I think that seems to dictate more than anything else in your team, because it's just so much money to have spent on one line. And so we've sort of been in favor of taking a rookie approach if you can find it, but often that's actually not available. And this year probably isn't there. And then next, starting by position, so looking at defenders, looking at how many rookies are going to be available, trying to squeeze at least two rookies on field if you can in defense, as long as there's enough available. And then how many rookies are going to be available in the midfield? Although I think there's been seasons where we've started with only one or two premiums in the midfield because there's just been so many rookies available there relative to the other lines. That's probably not a regular occurrence, though. I think that starting with probably three or four rookies on field in the midfield is pretty standard. And in the forward line, probably going for A, rookies, then seeing if there's any mid prices like Coniglio this year, Kerno, that sort of price bracket, and then looking at spending money on some premiums and what value are those premiums going to need to be. Yeah, getting those absolute elite must-have guys is probably the first priority once you start looking at premiums.
Starting structures can get a little bit messy from that point of view, because you are trying to, in the first instance, look to dictate your starting structure based on the plays that can deliver you the most points per dollar. And so beyond just looking at how many rookies you think you can start in each line, a good way to determine your starting structures to start by saying, well, how many rookies do I actually want to start on field? And so really looking at, you know, well, if I'm paying for a Horn Francis, if I'm playing for a Dacos, like who are the mature age rookies that I want to make sure are on field, because they're the ones that will overperform relative to their dollar. And then, you know, hopefully be able to find enough bench rookies to not push that risk equation too hard. So obviously if you have three super options in terms of midfield rookies that you want on field, but you can only find one or two other playing options to fill in your bench, the question is, do you take a third risky bench option so that you can force that extra rookie on field? I think you can afford to take a little bit more risks in the midfield with the rookies, also because there's three bench spots. So oftentimes you might take a riskier third midfield rookie in some instances to force a structure where you are playing, I guess, three awesome midfield rookies on field.
Yeah, and especially when looking at the rookie discussion we had last week when we were talking about expensive rookies versus cheap rookies, this year it's like I've never seen it, that there's just so many expensive rookies that are the best rookies available. I'd really need a really, really good reason to be spending over $150,000 on a bench player. As a general rule, I would try and avoid that. It might not be avoidable this year. You might end up having to do one in your midfield, depending on which players come up and if there are any of those cheaper rookies. I was interesting reflecting on your earlier point, Marcus, about just putting the value best where it is. I have never started a player in my midfield that was a premium that was available to start on another line. So I've never started a Rory Laird in the midfield if he was available as a defender, and I wouldn't start a Dunkley if he's available as a forward in the midfield. I would always start them either in forward or defense.
I think the only reason you would run into that is it's more of a team composition thing, right? I think it's more if you only had $500,000-$600,000 to spend instead of the 680s to hit tier one midfielders. I've seen teams do that, and I don't necessarily hate that, because I think the only priority and one of the topics that we have is, you know, captaincy options, and maybe it's a decent time to segue into that. Ultimately, you're trying to fill your team with 22 best scorers by the end of the season. It's just about your path getting there as quickly as you can. But at the start of the season, you're trying to do that as much, but balance trying to get as much value in your team at the start. And I think the only two players that I don't really want to compromise on those value stakes, who would be the top two scoring options for Supercoach in the year, because hopefully you put them as your captain and vice captain, you get to double their score. And so the impact of those two players and their top tier scoring counts a lot more than overpaying for your third premium midfielder or your fourth premium midfielder. The way Supercoach works as well is that as more points are scored and rookie prices go up, et cetera, the magic number, which is used to calculate player prices, starts to come down across the season. So if a premium holds their scoring, they finish last year averaging, they'll end up still dropping in price as the season goes on. So you're really only wanting to, I guess, overpay for the first two options. And then after that, you kind of prefer to hunt value a little bit more than you would necessarily picking the third and fourth highest scorer. Because early on in the season, it's more, how many points am I going to get per dollar spent? And I guess you just don't want to sacrifice too much in terms of your total scoring ceiling by taking too much of those compromises by the end of the year. But that's why I think playing a DPP out of position can work, because it sort of does fit into that strategy of you're still optimizing for your best 22. You're just saying, I can find more value in this spot with a DPP player than I can find with a premium mid.
It's an interesting debate. And I think that that's really clear shown if you're looking at Cripps versus Treloar in your starting side. So would you pick Cripps and Treloar, very similar prices? One has it forward eligibility, whereas one has to stay in the midfield for the rest of the year. And it's quite interesting if you're going to be making that decision. And I guess that's just how much money you have left over and how you're prioritizing your spending for the rest of your team. This year, I'm looking for less of those value premiums that we've sort of looked for in the past, and just trying to get the absolute top scorers on each line regardless of price to some extent, just because I don't want to end up with a compromised premium in any spot. So that's probably why I'm leaning towards not starting Cripps. I think that he's showed some real great stuff the other night. His score was probably inflated by 4 goals, but I really want to be making sure that I'm aiming for those top 8 or top 6 on each line rather than trying to eke out too much value. And in the past, I think we spoke last week a little bit that we've both fallen into the trap a little bit in the past of trying to find too many of those, aiming for too much value and sacrificing the scoring in the end for your final team.
And I guess if you're picking Treloar, especially if you're comparing him to Cripps and saying you're picking him out of position, it's because you see Treloar as potentially a top 6 forward. And so by picking Treloar, you are not sacrificing any of your potential ceiling of your team versus with Cripps, he may offer more value in that you may see Cripps averaging, you know, 110 versus Treloar averaging 105. But Cripps, relative to the potential true top 8 midfielders, could be giving up, let's say, another 5 or 8 points per game by the end of the season. So you would only pick Cripps based on what we've discussed if you believe that Cripps can get back to being a top 8 midfielder over Treloar, if you believe Treloar, which I reckon most people would, is a better chance of being a top 6 forward at the end of the year. So yeah, that's an interesting one. And Cripps certainly will be tempting a lot of people into picking him after the performance, the 4-goal, 157 Supercoach point performance. Kind of wish he did that for us last year.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's often, it's funny, you're often a year or two out with picking some of these guys. Like, there's plenty of examples where we've picked a player a year too early or 2 years too early and they end up showing it. But yeah, been burnt by that player by then and you don't end up taking them in your team.
So just quickly back to the point on captaincy options, Mark, is that something that you also go into the season with thinking about, or just the way you structure your team, do you often end up with two great captaincy options anyway? I guess year to year, this impact can be quite different in that there used to be a time where Gary Ablett was the standout player. So you kind of had to pick him and then you just had another foil and wasn't a big deal.
But you would, like,
I guess this year,
you were paying like $800,000 for Gary Ablett to start the year and it was still the right decision most of the time. Because he was just so far ahead of everyone else when it comes to captaincy option. And things have changed for a little bit. And the last couple of years, you've had a Gorn Grundy captain combination at different times has been the right way to go. You've had Lachie Neal as sort of a perma captain for a while. Last year, with rucks scoring a little bit less and there being more diversity amongst the midfield scorer with no like super standout, that became probably a bit more of an interesting battle. And I see that going on this year where it's a bit more open about that captaincy option. And it's not totally clear who the captaincy option is going to be. And you probably want to have maybe more options than previously. So limiting it to two is probably a little bit tight to me. I'd sort of be looking now to be having 4 players that you would consider captain, especially with vice captain and captain, well, with the vice captain loophole playing such a huge role. I just think it's why McRae becomes so obvious this year is because he just is great backup captain. He just never scores the 60s and 70s that can really ruin you if you have that player as a captain. Yeah, I'm probably looking at more than just 2 top guys as potential captains this year.
There's 4 premium midfielders that average more than the top scoring ruck from last year. And so I guess that illustrates the point that you were talking about before. And I guess it's rare that we've picked a player, not because they're great captaincy option, but they're a great vice captaincy option. And that is an interesting nuance. And I do agree with you that McRae and Steele as well, to that degree, they're both great vice captaincy backup options. To that end, despite the focus sort of shifting a little bit away from the rucks as your sole captaincy options, which for the last 2 years, most people sort of ran with a Gorn Grundy combo, I reckon 70% of the time. Despite us shifting a little bit away from that, I still do think that the rucks, when they have big games, and especially where there's uneven competition in terms of who the ruck opposition is, like, in the midfield, there's less of direct one-on-one competition than in the rucks, where hit outs to advantage gives you, what is it, plus 4, plus 5 points. And playing against an undersized ruck or a young ruck division, or if the number one ruck in another team sort of got injured, I do still think that the rucks still are often a great first hit because they just have so many more instances where the chance of them hitting 140 seems higher than in the midfield. The ability to take a bet on that and have that come off, I think is a little bit more reliable because of the nature of their contest. Probably Gawn's the most predictable from that point of view, with the way that he rucks. So Gawn's right up there in terms of a potential captaincy option, but certainly a ruck captain, McRae Steele backup captain is probably a good option to have going into season 2022.
Yeah.
Back to Strahling structures again. You did talk about wanting to fill your team with as many of the strong premiums as possible. The one part that you probably haven't touched on as much in terms of dictating structure is around the mid prices. I was sort of thinking rookies first, mid prices potentially second, your top tier captaincy options third, and then basically fill the rest in with top 22 premiums would be my order of priority, I think.
Yeah, I think mine's probably a little bit different. I think rookies first, which is always hard because you have to actually pick the rookies last because you actually don't know who's going to play. Yeah. So it makes things really difficult. Like the rookies determine your structure, but you actually don't know until the last minute who they're likely to be. And then I would have locks. So anyone that I think is an absolute lock in your team, just based on a positional change or whatever it might be. Then looking at the absolute top end premiums that you think that you have to have. And then looking at the returning injured players like a Sicily or whoever it might be, varies from year to year. And then looking at mid prices is probably how I would approach it.
Interesting. What would be the advantage there, Mark? I guess reducing the risk of having your team be overrun by mid prices. I guess in my mind, I was thinking you start there because that's potentially sort of great sources of value. And it's not necessarily that you're trying to lock in a heap of mid prices, but that camp to me falls into that, you know, lock territory where you just look at the amount of points that you think they're going to be able to get, you know, whether it's a player returning from injury or whatever, and the price point that they're at today and saying, this is a crucial bit of value that I want in this spot.
So I think that that's actually a bit of a trap because what ends up happening is if you start putting them in first, you probably find more than are necessary, whether it becomes 4, 5, or 6. And then you start locking your team into a certain structure that probably has less premiums in it. You can get some sort of confirmation bias with those players where you become too attached to having them in that spot or too attached to having one or two of them in those spots and you can't move around the other ones. So I think that my approach is to minimize the amount of guys that I have that are in the $200,000 to $300,000 price bracket and only have the absolute essential ones and by default be very skeptical of those players. And I think that that leads to a better team structure overall.
That is certainly a risk that I fall to each year. In relation to getting ready for the start of the season and lockout for Supercoach, as Mark mentioned, ultimately we end up getting our structure dictated to us once finally the rookies get named on team sheets. And so a lot of the exercise that you're going through in preparation for that final date, even when you're tinkering with your team and trying different configurations, it's all good practice because based on the cards that fall on that day, you want to have a little bit of flexibility and not having to come up with an emergency game plan 24 to 48 hours out. And so I don't think that you need to plan for having, or what if there are no midfield rookies at all, but it's more, if you are looking at a structure with three, it's probably a good idea to plan, what if I can only end up picking two on field because of whatever reason? Same in the back line, same in the forward line. So it's nice to plus or minus one rookie in each part of the ground so that when team sheets do get released, you kind of have an idea of how you would pivot your team to accommodate for what is eventuated.
Yeah, and I think that you said plus or minus there. I think that it should be plus and minus. So I think you need to be prepared. What happens if come selection, there's far more midfield rookies named than you had anticipated, and you're going to have much more capability of playing more on field, you should know which of your premium midfielders you're willing to drop, because otherwise you can just become so attached to them that you don't actually respond to the new information effectively.
All right. Now, preseason games. So what are the things that you are looking out for? What are the things that you are trying to avoid the noise on, I guess, avoid temptation on? How are you taking notes?
It's a tricky one, especially with only one game. That's added a heap of complexity to it. I guess we did have some evidence in the previous week with the practice games, which was good. With premiums, my general philosophy is, especially the older guys, so if you've got a player that's played for 10 or so years or has already shown a few seasons of premium scoring, I just want to say that they're fit. That's all that I really want to see, because likely their game time's managed, the position that they're playing in is managed, they're just trying to get a bit of a feel and get some run into the legs. And so I don't really care about their scoring too much. Players returning from injury, I want to see their game time's likely to be managed as well. So I just want to see that they've still got it and that you can see that they're still doing the things that you expect. So watching Sicily against Richmond, just making sure he's doing contested marking and taking a bunch of the kick-ins are probably the most important aspects on a player like that. Looking at rookies, that's the main reason to watch preseason games. So especially this week, are they in the starting 22 or are they in the emergencies, the extra three that they're allowed to play? Why is that? How much game time are they getting? What's their role? Is there a reason why their role is exaggerated during a preseason game? So we saw Ward from the Hawks today play predominantly midfield, but then Mitchell and O'Meara weren't there. So is that likely to continue? That's probably puts a little bit of a discount on what he was able to show. But then have they shown enough that they're going to be selected is the most important thing. Have they shown enough in a role that you think that they're actually going to be playing for the first 5 or 6 weeks, more than likely?
Because AFL is a weird game in that we also change the rules. Some years watching the preseason games is the first time we get to see how the rules affect potentially the way the game is played and therefore where points are scored. That's probably been a little bit more of a consideration in the last few years than it is this year, where hopefully there's a bit of stability. But that is something to note. We never previously had this much high-scoring defenders in Supercoach, and picking up on that shift in the preseason, that is something that you can get a fair bit of value out of. Other things to keep an eye out on, center bounce attendances and kick-ins. They're both large contributors to point scoring for the backline players that generate their scores from rebounds, and for the midfielders that essentially get first crack at scoring more points than the guy sitting out on the wing. Those things are important to have a bit of a look at, but you also need to layer in what might they be trying or giving certain players an opportunity at prior to the start of the season. And if they prove themselves, they may be starting in round one. It's not always indicative of what will occur in round one. So all these things are good to keep in mind. I guess you have to temper it with who's actually playing and who's not. Tom Mitchell's didn't play in today's game. As a result, a Hawks rookie looked a lot better today. And knowing that once you get to round one, that might change.
And the other thing is that sometimes preseason can be a little bit like the NBA All-Star game, where players are not defended as hard. You don't run a tagger in the preseason almost ever. And so players can just score way, way more because they can be more offensive with their play than they would be in the regular season.
Especially relevant to players whose scoring gets compromised because of the pressure that gets put on them once the real season starts. And Cripps, to a degree, falls into that camp where he hasn't really had too much problems even last year getting possessions, but the problem that he had was scoring points with the disposals of those said possessions and being under much more pressure, or his teammates being under much more pressure. And in the practice game, he got to play with a lot more freedom.
Yep.
Now, one of the topics that we have, but I don't think we need to labor it too much, was guns and rookies versus mid-price strategy. I think that is largely a solved equation these days, in that guns and rookies generally is what everybody goes with. And I think that debate used to be a little bit more relevant in the world of 20 trades, where you basically didn't always get to great teams by the end of the season, and you were balancing a lot more risk with a lot less options at your disposal. I think these days it's just a matter of how many mid prices you actually start and how much you're pushing that risk. But in general, most people will start with a Guns and Rookies template.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because it's still even a key theme on this show, which is how far you're pushing the mid prices. So are you starting with 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or even 0? And it is a repetitive concept that keeps coming up. I guess that we've got to the point where there's no ideal strategy. The default should be largely Guns and Rookies. And it depends on how many good mid prices are actually available and in each line per year, because they do provide some value, but you want to get them right.
And I think when you're looking at your mid price risk, it's also tough to put a rule. But generally, I would say that in terms of your risky mid prices, if you're anywhere beyond 4, you should tread with a lot of caution and ideally look for opportunities to bring that number down. We essentially are going to have 2 correction trades available to us, and potentially 3 now, I guess, with the trade boost prior to price changes. Essentially, if you're saying that the highest risk picks in your team are those mid prices compared to the Guns and Rookies, you're able to fix 2 of the 4 starting risky mid prices. If you only go into the season with 2, presumably you could swap both of them out and go true Guns and Rookies by the time round 3 rolls around. But I think that's sort of a good way of having a bit of a think about your risk, is that you have 2 opportunities to fix it.
Yep, it's fair.
Now on to the topic of durability, Mark. So this concept is obviously really important, especially as we head into a potentially COVID affected season.
How are we going to factor that one in?
Yeah. How much are you looking at durability? Is that something that you just evaluate on a single player basis, or at the end of each draft team, do you step back and then try and, you know, calculate the overall risk and then rejig the team that way? How zealous are you at managing overall durability risk across your team?
That's a real tricky one, mate. I think that I start with each player and work out their durability relative to price, relative to potential scoring. And so if a player has poor durability, you'd really want to be seeing a discount on their price, or the first time that they've done a full preseason in a long time or something along those lines. And then you do that throughout your team. And then, like you said, you actually assess it on a team-wide basis. It can be tricky by then, because you can become committed to each player individually, and it's hard to then go, okay, I'm going to reduce some of this durability risk from my team, even though I believe that each player in their own right is a good selection. Yeah. I probably find that quite a difficult process and difficult to add the durability back in to the team. It's extra tricky because you look at someone like Neil, who had insanely good durability and then missed a chunk last year and played injured through the last year, and like you got screwed because of durability with him. Same with Dusty from a couple of years ago, had missed 1 game in like 7 years, and then all of a sudden has missed like 30% of each of the last 2 years. It's no guarantee with durability. I think that what people are going to find this year is that their midfields are probably going to be fairly durable in the premium end, but when they look at their forward line, they're going to be picking players with pretty sketchy histories. So if you're looking at players like Dunkley, Heaney, Butters, Treloar, Degoe, any of those guys with high upsides relative to price, they've all got pretty terrible durability histories. And so you may end up with 3 of those guys in your team, and it could potentially be a problem.
I think you're right in that the way most people assess the risk is on an individual basis. And so once you've committed to that player, taking them out becomes challenging, and it's very much a discipline, I think, that you have to do if you want to enforce this within your team, because naturally that risk creeps as you search for value in the preseason. I think one thing I don't do really ever is assess durability from a total team point of view, but certainly the additional level of checking that I do is at a line level. And I think that that's a little bit easier to do as well, because evaluating injury risk can be very specific to each line. And some of it is just because the bench sizes are different. In your ruck line, you really want a super durable player, because if they go down, you have less cover there. In the midfield, you can take more of that risk because you have three potential players to cover. And not only that, the midfield rookies tend to be the higher scoring rookies. So you tend to be able to replace them with better scoring than sometimes in the back line or ruck out in the forward line. When you have to replace a premium on field with a rookie for a week or two, you can get punished with like scores in the 30s, you know, on the 20s. That's something else to consider. And ultimately, in the back line and in the forward line, you have two bench rookies, right? So I think going any more than two risky players is probably the threshold where, you know, then I try and bring back a little bit of that discipline. If I'm looking at three players, therefore half of my line being a little bit more injury prone, that's where I might say, well, which of these three are least likely to be in the top six, or least likely to burn me if I don't have them, or present the least amount of value, and use that as trying to enforce that discipline in making a cut, even though I may like that player.
So that becomes really tricky, because we're playing a game with incomplete information where you're looking to essentially gamble on upside versus the injury risk. And it's very easy to get blinded a little bit by the upside risk, especially at current prices, versus the durability risk, because that's sort of like, it's very much unknown and it's potential down the season, and you're not sure the timing of it can have a huge effect on how it plays out for your team. And players missing, like regularly missing 2 weeks, is just so difficult. I think that Nathan Fyfe's been a really good example the last few years, that he's been an absolute super coach beast, but it's probably been a mistake to pick him most seasons because his injury risk is just so high, and because he just misses an awkward amount of games where it's hard to actually trade him, or he'll miss at bad times. So do you think that this year that your analysis of that risk profile is any different because of A, players potentially missing because of COVID, which adds an extra level of needing benches, needing reliable players that are going to be out there every week? It might be harder to cover if you have a forward missing and then a COVID thing happens. But then we've been given five extra trades and the ability to use them more regularly. So has that impacted your assessment of durability on your team this year?
Yeah, I'm probably more conservative this year. And that's even with the additional trades and the trade boost situation, just because I'm expecting that I'm going to have players miss potentially a week here or there due to just happening to get COVID at an unfortunate time. And so I don't want to have a compounded effect of having injured players who are then out for 3 to 4 weeks and running thin with that throughout that period. The one thing on durability that helps guide where I take the durability risk is very much in terms of the players that I think can burn you if you don't have them. Basically, outside of those players, I'm not really interested in taking any durability risk, because enough of those burn players have durability risk. And oftentimes that's why they're discounted. So I wouldn't pick Treloar unless I thought Treloar could really burn you by not having him in the forward line for 480K. Because if he can score 110, 115 in a patch and you miss out on that, you know, that's a very significant score in the forward line as compared to the midfield. And it comes as a discount. So I guess it's at those points where I go, all right, fine, I'll stomach a bit of durability risk here. The good thing about doing that is there's not that many players that fall into that category, because really they're the top end players. So you can really only have top six, right? So in the back line, for example, Sicily and Whitfield, injury and suspension risk is really real, but we're more willing to say we'll go there because they could really burn you if you don't have them. Now, once I've committed to those two, I'm really not looking for any other durability risk premiums in the back line. I'd rather just go with a safer option, because I've kind of used my quota on the two, but it's for a good reason. So that's probably the one element that helps guide my durability risk more than anything else, is the ability for that player to burn me, and therefore that I'm happy to cross the line on and say, all right, now I'll stomach it.
How do you feel about the forwards though with this year? Like, all the players that I mentioned are probably the main ones that I'm considering, and all of the players that I'm considering in premium spots have injury risk on top of Canelio, who also has comes with injury risk.
The interesting part about some of those players is DPP helps. If they're forward mid, you can potentially hide them on another line for a little bit of time. That's probably one element. And I guess the other element is you're probably picking them because of some serious upside. So who are the players?
I think the ones that I mentioned were Dunkley, Heaney, Butters, Treloar, Degoe. That's probably the five. I was thinking about even Dusty. You could add Dusty to that list quite easily, given he's probably a durability risk now.
So I guess, again, in managing that, I'm trying to look at which of those I really believe have the highest ability to burn me, and then reducing my risk that way. Because I think you're right, you can't afford to take five. And so this is where you get to the point where you go, I might even use durability as the factor here and say, I'm just going to skip out on two of them. And ideally, the two that are also least likely to burn you, right? So who has the highest upside of those and go with them? In that list, it's probably like Dunkley becomes probably the most obvious one.
But he's also then the most expensive, so you lose some discount there. But yeah, he is the most obvious one.
Yeah, but I'm caring less about value at this particular point, because in terms of those plays that you talked about, they're all reasonably expensive. You're picking them because they could be 110 plus in the forward line, right?
They've all got the burn factor potential.
So who's most likely to do 110 plus? And the ones that are at the bottom of the list, I cull them. So this is definitely a more conservative approach to playing the game, right? Because the risky approach is to say the upside is there, just take all of them. But in general, I do like managing that risk to a certain degree. And actually, of all those players, maybe Degoe is the most obvious call.
Well, it's interesting though, because out of all of them, he probably has the highest upside, but he also comes with by far the most risk.
That's the challenging part, right? Is that when we talk about upside, you're wanting to look at the percentage likelihood of 115 plus, 110 plus, 105 plus. So Degoe might have the highest likelihood of going 115 plus, let's say, but he might have a significantly smaller percentage of going, let's say, 110 or 105 compared to some of the other options, where you know that they're more likely to step up to that benchmark, but you don't quite think that they're going to get to 115. So Heaney, for example, he would seem safer for 105, but less likely for a 115 comparing him to Degoe. You can't just look at, well, what's the absolute ceiling? You have to look at what is the threshold for uber performance in a line, which in the forward line is probably somewhere between 105 and 110. Put a percentage on that, and then also put a percentage on the absolute ceiling, and use that together to come to your decision making. And then layering injury risk. And the one thing that I probably wouldn't care so much about for this particular class of players is price.
Yeah, I think Dunkley's really the exception, because all the others are sort of between that 400,000 and 500,000. So don't make the decision based on saving 30K, because it's not one of those close decisions where it doesn't really matter which one you go. It's actually the results by the end of the year on total points scored amongst those five is actually likely to be really significant.
Yeah, exactly. And where you care about the 30K is maybe where you're tossing up between, I don't know, Steele or McRae or Oliver. The margin for error is a lot smaller, and if you need to scrimp 30K there, do it there. You're still going to get a great B option. With this class of players, you're picking the breakouts. You're picking the burn players. So you're picking them because you're kind of structuring part of your team around them, not because you want to save 30K.
It could be 20 points a game difference between some of these players without even factoring in the durability and injury factor. So that could cost you trades, it could cost you like donuts, like the differences could be really significant.
So with everything that we've talked about on durability, how do you think you're going to approach managing this risk in the forward line?
She's this where I just say, and now look forward to the Patreon podcast because I will answer the question there. Or do I actually answer it here? Short answer is those guys are the forwards that I'm considering. And so I'm probably start between 2 and 3 premium forwards. And so I will be taking on a lot of durability risk in the forward line because I think the upside is high. And if you get those guys right, they're the ones that will put you into contention by mid-year.
The recap of that is that you are going to ignore durability.
No, because I think that I know that you said it's not a team-wide thing, but I think that it is probably more to some extent. But then you mentioned Sicily and Whitfield, and I'm like, oh God, what am I doing? I think that you have to take risks on durability in order to win the competition. To give yourself the best chance of overperforming is you take risks on durability and those risks play out in your favor.
So you're swinging for the fences this season.
I'm always swinging for the fences, Marcus.
That is true. That is true. I do play more conservatively than you do. I just have one finishing point, and that's to say durability matters much more with your premiums than with your mid prices that are step ladders. Oftentimes step ladders, especially if they're players returning from injury, if they're cheap enough and you're happy to trade them out after scoring some points for you and gaining some cash, it doesn't matter that they're unlikely to make it through an entire season unscathed. They basically just have to play a large enough block of games to appreciate and then toss them out. But when we're talking about these premiums that are at 450 that you're hoping obviously stay in your team for the whole season, that's where sort of durability plays a much larger part. So that's probably the only other point I'll add to finish on durability. We went quite deep in that show, so hopefully that all made sense to people. If not, please feel free to reach out to us, especially if you're new to the show. Some of the things that we talk about, I guess we've built on and talked to our community about over the years. So if you've been listening to us for a while, you probably could follow most of that. But if we started speaking any jargon inadvertently or referred to things that need a bit more explaining, do reach out to us on social media or whatever else, and happy to clarify or have conversations and take feedback as we did in last week's episode. Thanks very much for an interesting conversation there, Mark. I think every time we do one of these certainly gets us to think a little bit more critically about the amount of drift that we've had between what we say we should be doing and what you end up being tempted into during a preseason. So I like it as a focusing point. And we did get a bit of feedback about that from last week's episode, that people tweak their teams a little bit after hearing a little bit from sort of a broader strategy standpoint. So hopefully that was helpful to you. Again, reach out to us with feedback, and patreon.com/supercoachcoach if you want to get the player specific advice for building your team. Looking forward to the forward show tomorrow, Mark, where I think it's going to be the most complex that we've done for the four positions, and wonder how long that one's going to be.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of players in consideration, and there's a lot of really good arguments for and against some of these players, so that should be fun.
All right. Thank you very much for your time and your support, and we'll catch you next time. See ya.
See ya. Yeah.